Good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this, our 12th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the right here, Peggy Wright, with help from our webmaster taking pictures at the back, Haiwan Wan, and our research instruction coordinator at the back collecting names, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Terry Perkins. Our speaker tonight is a native of Vanceburg, Kentucky, where her family have lived since the early 1900s. And growing up in Lewis County, she was inspired by her grandmother, who was a hardworking, independent woman, active in her community, and a great cook. She graduated from the University of Louisville, where she majored in studio art and received her Master of Fine Arts from Ohio State University, and her Master of Library and Information Science with a specialization in archives and records management from the University of Pittsburgh, where she worked on the Historic Pittsburgh Project. After working for the Ohio State University's Cartoon Research Library, she moved to Lexington, Kentucky to become project archivist for the Lexington Herald Leader's photograph collection before becoming Director of Archives for the University of Kentucky. She's presently the Associate Dean for Special Collections and Co-Director of the Wendell H. Ford Public Policy Research Center in the University of Kentucky Libraries in Lexington, Kentucky. Her first book, Women in Lexington in the Images of America series, was published by Arcadia Press in 2006. In her newest book, The Historic Kentucky Kitchen, Traditional Recipes for Today's Cook, which she co-authored with Chef Andrew McGraw for the University Press of Kentucky in 2013, she presents more than 100 recipes, mostly from handwritten manuscript sources found in the University of Kentucky's Special Collections Unit, each one of which has been tested. It's a cookbook with a purpose. In her spare time, she chairs the University of Kentucky's Sesquicentennial Committee for their 2015 celebrations. Please give a warm welcome to Deidre Skaggs.
Thank you. Listening to someone else talk about me, it makes me feel a little schizophrenic. I have a strange background. So I decided I would take a little bit of a different approach tonight in talking about the cookbook. I've talked about it for the past year, and I love talking about it, but I thought I would do something new tonight. I've loosely titled my talk, Dining in Kentucky as an Art, which I will get back to. As Brian mentioned, I am from Vanceburg, Kentucky, so in case you were wondering where that is, I put a big blue star in the general locale. Right along the Ohio River and in northeastern Kentucky, in an area that's not, you know, it doesn't fit in eastern Kentucky. We don't fit in northern Kentucky. People say things like pop and warsh, and, you know, it's a strange place to be from, but lovely. So Brian also mentioned my grandmother. So to me, food is completely connected to memory, or maybe my memory is completely connected to food. So my childhood, I was an only child, and I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, and this is her kitchen. So her table was right there in the middle of the kitchen, and she cooked all the time, and I sat at the table and did, you know, everything from play to do homework to eat, and all of our big family meals were, they also took place at this table, and she's the person that taught me that, or who showed me that she was going to do something special for everyone during these holiday meals. So for my uncle, she always had Coca-Cola in glass bottles. For my other uncle, she always made brown beans with raw white onion on the side. For me, it was, I needed both mashed potatoes and yeast rolls. And then for my cousin, it was the Barks red cream soda. That's what she always got. So these times were really special, and every holiday meal that I had as a child was around this particular table. So to give you an example, it wasn't until I went to college at the University of Louisville that I learned that tomatoes, which there are some tomatoes there, and her bowl of cucumbers that were always in vinegar that we always had in the summer. I didn't know that tomatoes weren't a delicious red juicy thing until I went to U of L, and I think I went to Denny's and got a salad that had tomatoes on it, and it was horrifying for me. So this picture hangs in my kitchen. It's another one of my grandmother holding her cast iron skillet. And if you have the cookbook, or if you do get a cookbook tonight, you'll notice that among the dedications, one is to my grandmother and her cast iron skillet. So I have this cast iron skillet, and I used it in every recipe where it was appropriate to use a cast iron skillet in testing these recipes. So my grandmother never wrote anything down. You know, she cooked by taste and by smell and by touch, which was something that I had to learn throughout this process. You know, I cook a lot, but I have no formal training in cooking. And so I had to really learn how to trust my own, or to gain instincts in cooking, and not to rely on measurements and standardization that I'm used to and take for granted. So one of the things that my grandmother cooked was fried potatoes, which, of course, she used bacon grease, so they were delicious for that reason. But she also cut them in a perfect way, so there were crispy ones and tender ones. And there's a recipe in here for a dry skillet hash. That's the closest thing that I've ever had to her fried potatoes. So once I discovered that, I felt like the whole cookbook was a success. So I was driven to pursue this 3-year endeavor because, like I said, cooking is really about memories to me, and cooking for other people is about creating those memories. I only like to cook for other people. If I'm home alone, I'll probably have a quesadilla or a salad every single night. But if I can cook for other people, then it's going to be far more complicated than it needs to be. So the Historic Kentucky Kitchen is a cookbook. It's one that could be used by any average home cook today. It's also, I call it a light history because I'm also not a historian, but I did a lot of historical research for this particular book. And so that conveys throughout the book when examining trends, Southern cuisine, regional cooking, and just the history of the evolution of food over time. So there are over 100 recipes that span the years 1850 through 1950, so almost roughly 100 years of regional cuisine. They are almost completely all from handwritten recipes from special collections. They represent recipes that were found in 12 Kentucky family papers and then 5 historic cookbooks that we had in the collection. So this is Andrew McGraw. I thought I should at least show a picture of him. This is him with his wife and his twins, and he does work as a sous chef now. So, but in telling the story of how it started, Andrew has a degree in library and information science, and he was processing a collection. And he asked me a question one day about processing this particular collection, which was the Logan English papers. And it didn't take long before he was like, oh, but look at this really cool recipe that I found. And so this is the recipe that he found. We started talking about this particular recipe and thinking that, you know, as an archivist, we look at pieces from history, we talk about history, but how amazing would it be to take something out of the archives and bring it alive in a way that people could eat and enjoy and talk about in a much more tangible way. So we talked about it. We didn't do it. We talked about it like we do. But the thought, you know, lingered there in our minds about this particular concept, and wondering if there were other recipes in the archives and if there were enough to really do something with. So Logan English is one of the family papers that's represented in the cookbook. Logan English was born in Paris, Kentucky in 1928, and he went to the Millersburg Military Institute, graduated from Georgetown College, and served briefly in the Korean War. He went on to become a folk singer and songwriter, and that's what he's most well known for. He made 6 albums, which were mostly Kentucky folk ballads, Woody Guthrie songs, and folk classics. So I thought I would just play a little bit of his music to sort of add to the context of the people and the families whose recipes I was pulling from. About it some more, realized there were a lot more recipes, decided we would get together and try a recipe as part of this process, as we pretty quickly discovered this recipe is the perfect example. You've got 3 eggs, 7 tablespoons of sugar, and I guess you just throw it all together and bake it for a certain amount of time, maybe in a 350 degree oven or so. So we had some recipes, and we decided we were going to make white mountain cake. So we pieced it together, we put it in the oven, we waited, took it out of the oven. It was terrible. It was raw, it was overcooked, and somehow managed to have no flavor. It didn't even taste burnt. It was just terrible. So I'm pretty tenacious, and I was like, all right, this white mountain cake is not going to stop me from my, you know, romantic notion of taking the archives out of the archives and bringing them alive. So I made it again. Tried it differently, different size pan, smaller. Still terrible. Terrible. I tried to make the icing that went on it, and it made it even worse. So I had another recipe. The lemon custard pie. It seemed pretty simple, so I felt better about this, and it was a pie. Seems less complicated than a cake. Did a ton of research nonetheless on, you know, different ways to make lemon custard pie. Happened to have all of the ingredients, which was a plus, and baked the pie, and it smelled really good, you know, again, tapping, waiting. It's a custard pie, so, you know, it should have sat for a while before slicing it, but I couldn't wait because I'm also impatient, and it was really good. So my romantic idea had come back to life. So around this time, we approached the University Press of Kentucky. They publish regional cookbooks and regional histories, and they committed their interest to the cookbook. So we proceeded. So in continuing to do research, it presented a lot of the challenges associated with manuscript recipes. So these are recipes that aren't published. So again, the instructions are few and far between. The handwriting is hard to read. And I grew up writing in cursive, so I have somewhat of an advantage to today's generation. But it was still really hard in many situations to interpret this recipe. Is Frances Jewell McVeigh, who was at one time Dean of Women at the University of Kentucky and went on to marry Frank McVeigh, who was president of the university. She was known as the First Lady of Maxwell Place. Maxwell Place is the name of the presidential home. And she had lots of parties, and this is her spiced tea recipe, which is really good. But also no instructions. I've had it hot and cold. It's good both ways. Another part of doing research in the historical capacity was learning that recipes were often called receipts. So when we were looking through the databases and collections that we had, we were looking for receipts, we were looking for recipes, we were looking for anything that might say chicken or bean or pig or pork or milk or anything. But within these family papers, we were fortunate to find entire journals. This is one such journal. It was a mass-produced journal specifically for recording receipts with beautiful illustrations. It's where the knife from the front slide cover came from. But you can see, I mean, it's still, she has very neat handwriting, but it's precise and almost illegible in its preciseness. So the lack of information was certainly a challenge. The lack of consistency in terms of how much is butter the size of a hen's egg? Or how much is butter the size of a walnut? So this is where the historic cookbooks helped, although the historic cookbooks were not consistent either, because one historic cookbook said that butter the size of a hen's egg was 2 tablespoons, and another one said that butter the size of a hen's egg was 4 tablespoons. So I tried to research how big a hen's egg would have been in 1890. And then I made butter the size of a hen's egg. And then I measured it. So I came up with my own interpretations. Another challenge, quantity. If you look through this recipe, it starts off with 4 quarts of mushrooms. You go on, there's 4 cups of water. There's 4 cups of flour. The soup makes a pot this big. And I'm pretty good at math. And so, you know, this was the perfect example for all those times in school when your teacher says, you're going to use this one day. And you think, no, I'm not. Yeah. Well, when I had to reduce this recipe down by an 18th, it came in very handy that I could do some math. Even still, the way that I reduced it still makes a pot this big. But I've made this soup many times. So this is also a recipe from Frances Jewell McVeigh, her papers. But you can see that it's attributed to someone else. And many times these names are illegible. So that's why throughout the cookbook, I maintain the attribution of the family papers they came from. I acknowledge the fact that they could have come originally from a neighbor, they could have come from a family member, they could have come from the servants who worked in these particular homes. Sometimes they were affluent families. So I tried to acknowledge that in the introduction, and I had to give up very quickly on trying to figure it out. Before I move on to some of the families, I have to share some more stories from my testing process. So there were approximately 2 years of researching, collecting recipes, and testing those recipes. So we had an overall goal to include about 100 recipes in the cookbook. So we'd probably compile somewhere around 200 possibilities. In doing research, you know, I really wanted it to be representative of Southern food history and culture, so I had a list of things that had to go in the cookbook. Fried chicken, mayonnaise, pound cake, biscuits. Being from the bluegrass region, there also had to be beaten biscuits. There had to be a cornbread recipe. There had to be something made with bourbon. And I could, you know, there are other things that were on my list, which also made it a challenge when you're looking for a very specific recipe, when you're dead set on finding that pound cake recipe in a collection that it may or may not exist in. So I'd become really intrigued by hickory nuts. There's a restaurant in Maysville, Kentucky called Chandler's that has a hickory nut pie. When I had it, I fell in love with it. So I was really excited when I found a recipe for hickory nut cake in Mary M. Peters' 1889 handwritten recipes. So I called Chandler at Chandler's restaurant because he's a very nice man, and I asked him where he got his hickory nuts. And he was like, oh, I get them online. It's, you know, it's fine. Because it wasn't the time of year that hickory nuts were falling from the trees. I tried asking everyone I knew. So I ordered my hickory nuts. I was super excited, not so excited that they cost about $25 to $30 by the time I pay for shipping. So I got all the ingredients, I got the box in the mail, and I was ready to make my hickory nut cake. Until I opened my bag. And in my excitement, I didn't specify shelled hickory nuts. So one of the problems with hickory nuts is that they're really hard to get into. And a little bit of internet research will tell you, you need this special contraption that like screws into it and then, you know, basically whacks it open. I don't have one of those. I tried a hammer and nail. I tried beating them. And then I got my grandmother's cast iron skillet and a kitchen cloth and my concrete steps and really beat them. Which works. My editor tried to make me take this out of the cookbook because there are notes, you know, about, you know, try this dish with that, or, you know, maybe you should substitute this. And for the hickory nut cake, it says, you know, don't try beating it with the skillet. It works, but I wouldn't recommend it. So I spent an hour picking the tiny shells out of the meat of the hickory nuts. And when I was done, I barely had a cup of hickory nuts, which was exactly what I needed to make the cake. But again, this is a cake, and I'm not a baker by any means. And so then I became afraid that my hickory nut cake wouldn't turn out the first time. And then I would have spent, like, the last 3 hours with hickory nuts and a terrible cake. So I fretted. You know, I stood at the oven and watched it, and I waited, and I took it out, and it worked. With the exception of, like, every other bite, you know, that shell that I missed. So, I wouldn't really call that one a failure, but it wasn't a great success either. The cake tasted great. I went back and told Chandler that story. I took him a cookbook, and he just started laughing at me, and he walked back to his kitchen, and he came out with this bag of the most beautiful, perfectly halved hickory nuts. So, I have an order in, from Wisconsin, so I'm waiting. It was funny, after that, there were people all over the place who were like, oh, my neighbor has hickory nuts, and he has that thing, and he's got hickory nuts in his freezer. I don't know where everyone is when you really need them, but. One of the other great disasters was the, it was called a bourbon pudding, and this particular recipe was, the paper was really faded, you know, it's an old, I think this recipe was from around 1890 or so. So the paper is stained, the ink is brown, and it's begun to fade. It's written on both sides, so you get the handwriting from the other side coming through to the front. And it had very little instruction, you know, it's like some milk and some sugar and some bourbon, and you bake it in a sweet crust. And it's like, okay, this is a pie. And so I'm still convinced, though, that this pie is a little bit like a southern caramel frosting. You know, if the humidity is weird, it's still going to be a little bit strange. So the first time that I made it, I didn't really treat it like a pudding. I didn't turn it into a pudding first. And so I put it in the shell, and I baked it, and I had bourbon pudding soup pie, and it didn't work. So that was when I really had to do a lot more research into puddings from this time and how to then transition that pudding into a pie. It ultimately worked, and I have made it in both success and failure numerous times since then, so I'm blaming the humidity on that one. One of the other, I guess it was a success, but I refused to put it in the cookbook. It was vinegar pie. And while you may see pies with a little bit of vinegar, cakes with a little bit of vinegar, this was like a half a cup of vinegar and a half a cup of cream. It doesn't take a lot of science to know that it's going to curdle. And so it did. And I baked it, and it came out, and it looked curdled. And kind of gray. So I closed my eyes and I took a bite, and it was pretty good. I wouldn't have known it was vinegar. You know, it tasted like a citrus pie. But I imagined, you know, someone like our lovely critic in the back, you know, opening the cookbook and thinking how interesting that recipe sounded, and then making it and it coming out like a brain-like goo and then discrediting the entire cookbook. So I promptly eliminated that from the process. So I'll transition to a little bit about some of the other families that are represented in the cookbook. The Breckenridge family is one that's represented in both. This is the daughter, but it was Louise Ludlow Breckenridge and her daughter, Lucy Hayes Breckenridge. Louise Ludlow, who was a Dudley, was born in 1849 in Lexington, and she married Joseph Cavell Breckenridge, who was a major in the Union Army under William Tecumseh Sherman. They had 13 children. Yes. And the cookbook is dated 1876, so it's a pretty early representation of these handwritten recipes. Which brings me to why it was so important to me that I use handwritten recipes. To me, it seemed that these were recipes that either meant something more to the family, or that they were recipes that were actually made by the family. Many of them, like this, which was Lucy Hayes Breckenridge's, she had notes that she would often write in the corners of her recipes. So this one said, excellent. So immediately I wanted to test this one, and it was an excellent recipe. So that's why it was important that I stick with the handwritten recipes. They felt so much more meaningful and connected to me. One of the things that I learned, speaking of oysters, was that, maybe naively, but I was a little surprised by how many seafood recipes there were in these early handwritten recipes, specifically oysters. But with the canning process that was happening during that time, by 1856, you could find them as far west as St. Louis. So it was actually fairly common to find oysters in Kentucky, certainly Lexington. So it really bothers me that I cannot find a photo anywhere of Mary M. Peter, and that I have to show you an image of her husband, Alfred M. Peter, but it's going to have to do for the purpose of my visual aid. This is another recipe book that was in a totally different collection. He was a collector. You know, he went to flea markets, antique stores, and purchased things. And so this was in his papers, but he had purchased it. And so all it said was Mary, I think finally I found her name, Mary, but it was written M.M. Peter, 1889. And so after doing some research based on the other family member or the other names that were attributed in her cookbook and using ancestry.com, I finally linked her to Alfred M. Peter, who was a chemistry professor at the University of Kentucky in 1889. It was also the year that they got married. So I've speculated that she formed this cookbook when they got married so that she could set up her own house and cook for him. The other interesting part about the Peter family, I've included the daguerreotype in the bottom. Alfred M. Peter's father was Dr. Robert Peter. He was a doctor, and he also taught at the medical school that was at Transylvania at the time. He had gone to Europe in 1839, which is the year that the daguerreotype, the photography process, was patented. So he, in addition to purchasing the medical equipment that he bought during that time, he purchased photography equipment. It's the background of photography. So he's credited with being the first person to bring photography to Kentucky. So, interesting side note about them. So over the 3 years, I wondered a lot why this mattered to put together a compilation of recipes for people who aren't from my family, might have no direct connection to. But as an archivist, I do believe in the power of collective memory, the things that we all share. And I think specifically with food, it's something that we can talk about or relate to people regardless of your age, your gender, your class, economic status, any of those things. And so to me, despite that it's not my family or your family, it's still a part of all of our Kentucky heritage. You know, these are recipes that were common during a particular time and in a particular place. And so in this way, I think it is a part of all of us. Additionally, by publishing these manuscript recipes, it puts them in the hands of many more people. You know, when they're in the archives, they're hard to find, first of all, and not as many people are going to see them and certainly not try them. And so in this way, I think it does help to keep history alive. And then I also hope that it generates awareness and interest in culinary history. If I would have maybe been a little older or thought more about preserving information like this, I might have asked my grandmother to write down a single one of her recipes, which I think I have about four of her recipes because she didn't write any of them down. So maybe we'll encourage other people to ask for recipes, to look for them, or to save them as well. You know, and I'm terrible. I cook from recipes that are online all the time on my Epicurious app, on my phone, and on my iPad. So I need to listen to myself and either start printing them out and write notes on them of what I do. And I also think that it preserves the bits of history, the parts of everyday life that are so much more significant in a lot of ways than, you know, not that they're more significant, that's a terrible thing to say, but we don't often preserve those things in the archive. You know, you get the rich white man complex and all the really important things that they did and all the luxuries that money could afford them, but, you know, this is part of that common experience of something that we need and something that we all do. So, I'll explain that in just a second. So one of the inspirations, as I was going through, you know, the research kept me inspired. And so I had mentioned Frances Jewell McVeigh. She, in addition to being an amazing hostess and an academic, and she wrote for a variety of publications. She wrote on food, she wrote on farming, on gardening, agriculture. So it was in the New York Times on September 5th of 1937 in an article that she wrote where she said, "Dining in Kentucky is an art, and as an artistic expression, it has been created by, and in turn, it creates the vivacity, ardor, frankness, generosity, yea, even courage of the people of the Bluegrass State." I got curious to know how many sticks of butter you would need if you were going to make every recipe in the cookbook. So here's a visual representation for you. It's around 56 sticks of butter, so that's how many you would need if you want to go home and make them all, which is about 12, 13 pounds of butter. You would also need around 144 eggs also to accomplish that. I'm happy to go ahead and, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer some of those, or I can just stop and stare at you all for a while.
I remember trying to get recipes from my grandmother. There were no measurements. It was, well, maybe it was like one or two eggs, but it was like four handfuls of flour. Well, my handful is bigger or smaller than her handful. It's, how do you know how many cups? And I think with baking, it is more on measure to get an outcome, you know, rather than throwing a casserole together. And I gave up trying to do them. I mean, they were good, but there was no way they could be duplicated. Little bit of this? What is a little bit?
Yep. Yeah. So I included a chart in the beginning of the book so that if someone was going to go and try and tackle other handwritten or historic recipes, if there's a gill or a coffee cup or a teaspoon, you might be able to know what it is.
I was wondering if the means of cooking from then, like wood stoves or open hearth even, made a difference when you used your electric stove or the gas ovens or something like that.
Well, I mean, it was all so experimental that, you know, it was a constant state of adjustment. But I think that, I mean, if anything, it made it easier just in terms of the consistency of the temperature of an oven and the range top. So I think it made it easier. And since they certainly didn't say put on the hearth, you know, I didn't really know, other than trying to estimate on dates, what may have been used at the time. The one thing that I lament that I couldn't really do was any of the pickling, because of the time that it needed to pickle and the quantities where I was done with the math at that point.
The odd ingredients that you just never heard of before?
Not as many as I thought. I was ready to be perplexed a lot. I mean, the most common things were some of the fats. There was beef tallow. That was one. There were a few things that I wouldn't try. One of them, which was from the Henry Clay family papers. Henry Clay was their family was very wealthy. So, but there was a very detailed recipe for stewed calves' head, the entire head. So, I mean, it probably would have been hard to get a small cow's head, and I didn't really want to pull the brains out and beat it with an egg to thicken the soup, so I didn't go with that one. But yeah, there were more, there were lots of raisins and currants and cloves and nutmeg and things like that, but an onion juice, that was really the one thing that perplexed me, because we don't really sell bottles of onion juice, so I just chopped it up really, really fine. So it was really just the fats, you know. I didn't use lard. I did substitute oils and butters for those things. But otherwise, I tried to keep it true to the original intent of the recipe.
Did you mention recipes where, like the calf's head, that they used every part of what was available and discard?
I didn't, and I think because they weren't written down. I didn't find a lot of recipes that would have represented the Appalachian region, which in my growing up, we were certainly influenced by that. So personally, I was a little disappointed in not finding some of those things. I mean, there were some things that called for game, you know, things that people would have been able to hunt and provide for themselves. And the same thing, though, with the vegetables and things like that. They were local ingredients that they would have had access to. But, you know, not a lot of those. Burgoo was one of the hard recipes to find that was scalable. And the burgoo recipe that I found was very tame. You know, it was chicken, and it wasn't specific on what else to put in there. Do you have a question?
Yes. For the time period that you had drawing the recipes from, did they have like actual formal recipe books at that time that they would like draw from, or was it mainly family text?
Yeah, there weren't very many at that time. There was one fairly significant one that had come out of Virginia, and we had many of those in our collection, and they were similar in that they didn't have a lot of specificity with ingredients and things like that. And while there were many of the recipes that you could find in that cookbook, there were just as many, if not more, that weren't represented in some of those mass-produced cookbooks of the time.
Back here.
Did you find things like, did you find recipes like including things like dandelion weed or dandelion leaves, local plants that you wouldn't normally think of putting in food nowadays?
I didn't. That sort of went along with my disappointment of not finding an apple stack cake, which was the staple of my childhood. And I had lots of relatives who foraged for dandelion greens, and that was something that was very common for them to do, but I did not. And it probably, I think it relates to the fact that the families that are represented in these collections are still middle to upper class, and so you don't get that representation, the diversity that you would want to see, where maybe you might find
a poke salad or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although there are some poke salad recipes.
Are there some poke salad? Yeah. Yeah, over here.
So I would imagine that actually a lot of the recipes that were published at that time were probably in magazines magazines and newspapers. Were some of those helpful in helping you to decipher some of what was going on?
They were. There was one particular collection, the Means family collection, and they had this really big scrapbook, and it was just full of these tiny cut-out recipes that were just pasted, you know, sort of obsessively on the pages. And then there would be handwritten recipes interspersed. So it was really helpful because, you know, there could be that particular cookbook or recipe book had a recipe for carrot pie, and there were like three different versions of the carrot pie. And so whereas one might not have instructions on what it would have said, you know, a moderate oven or a fast oven, the other one might actually include that information. So it was a great way to cross-reference that material.
Did you get a sense of that Lexington was more cosmopolitan than you thought it might have been for ingredients or not?
Yeah, it was. I mean, one of the things that I noted throughout is that there's a lot of, to me anyway, simple recipes. You know, there's not a lot of extra stuff going on. You get the basics, but there are things that are put together in a way whose sophistication surprised me. And I think part of it too is that they would have been using really fresh, truly local ingredients. You know, the milk would have come from a farm really close, or maybe from, you know, on their own land. And so when they're talking about sweet milk, you know, it's very fresh sweet milk, and soured milk isn't buttermilk, it's really milk that's soured, and our milk won't sour because it's too processed. And so I tried to replicate that, much to the chagrin of my bank account. So I bought local milk and I bought real cream and went to the farmer's market and got fruit that was in season. But there were two dishes that I can think of right now that when I made, I thought, you know, you could go to any southern fine dining restaurant and, you know, this would be something that could be on their menu. One was called for partridges, which I used Cornish hens, and they're stuffed with sweet potatoes and wrapped in bacon, and it was delicious. And then there's a chicken pie, which is like a chicken pot pie with a biscuit top, and the biscuit top is like this tall, so it's really dramatic and really great. So yes, I was surprised by how sophisticated many of the dishes were, and you know, you could definitely see the French influence. There's so many things that have a roux base.
Time for one more.
Okay, it's actually kind of a theory. Do you think that part of the reason why you didn't find a lot of the Appalachian representative recipes is because many of them were undereducated?
It's quite possible, and we have Appalachian collections. You know, we have a pretty good set of papers relating to different aspects of Appalachia. But and I also wonder too, though, if the family—not all. This is sort of a generalization, but you have families in Appalachia who are very close. Maybe they kept them. You know, maybe they passed them on to someone else instead of leaving them in papers to be donated to an archive one day. So I think that could apply as well.
Well, I'm sure Deidre will be happy to answer some questions. We have some books here to sell, and it's now time for our door prize. We'll be giving away a copy of the book, which I'm sure you'll be pleased to sign, won't you, and a couple of our t-shirts. And I'll get my colleague that's right to exceed that. And, a little token of our appreciation for our speaker, and congratulations. We'll be doing book signing here on behalf of our friends organization. I want to thank you for coming out on an extraordinarily cold night, and but we've got a warm-hearted author here just waiting to sign some books. So we will resume our Kentucky Live series in February. Next week we will be doing a program in our Faraway Places series, a program on sacred places of the Himalaya and Tibet. So I hope you'll join us then. Thank you and have a good evening.